This is Solve It for Kids.
Hey, my curious friends, so great to see you. Hi, my name is Jed Lee, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek into the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using curiosity, creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. Please welcome to the show my partner in exploration, the Dean of all things STEM and STEAM, Jennifer Swanson.
Hi, Jed. I am so excited about the show today. We are going to answer the question,
how do you map an underwater forest?
To help us solve that question, we want to welcome aquanaut and marine scientist Dr. Brian Helmuth from Northeastern University. Dr. Helmuth is part of a team of scientists who are allowed to dive to discover the mysteries of this underwater forest.
What is an aquanaut? Like, what do you do as an aquanaut?
Yeah, I mean, an aquanaut is someone who works underwater, and I guess more specifically, who lives underwater. Ooh. So like an astronaut, as you know, goes into space, and they live in space for a certain number of days, an aquanaut lives in the bottom of the ocean. And so that's part of what we do for my job.
So, like, what things do you encounter under the ocean? Like you sound like it's easy, just live under the water, but I'm thinking there's way more to it than that.
Yeah, there is a lot more, but it is so cool. I love it so much. It's my favorite thing in the world, actually, to do, because usually when we dive, we have to go down and we breathe air and we run out of air and we have to come back up to the surface again. But when you're an aquanaut, you go back into your house, which is on the bottom of the ocean. So it's almost like a school bus in the bottom of the ocean. I always think of like Miss Frizzle and the magic school bus. So we just swim back in and we get lunch and then we go back out again. And so when we're usually kind of rushing around trying to get work done on a regular dive, we get to spend time and get to know our neighbors while we're down there. So we get to see all the animals that are down there, and it actually gives you this moment to really feel like you're a fish.
Well, so one of the things we want to talk about on this show, since we are talking about problem solving, is tell us about your latest adventure / research project. Which I know all about because I think it's very exciting, but let's share it with our listeners.
Yeah, this is so cool. So two ice ages ago, not the last ice age, but two ice ages ago, about 60,000 years ago, there was a cypress forest. Over time, as the ice melted and sea levels rose again, we know that sea levels rise naturally, but it normally takes tens of thousands of years for that to happen. Now we're seeing a lot faster. Eventually that forest got covered by water and then got covered by dirt, by sediment that was building on top of it until it became buried. And it's been locked away for the last 60,000 years until a big hurricane came along, Hurricane Ivan came along and uncovered it. And wow. So, a couple of fishermen in off the coast of Alabama, started noticing they're catching a lot of fish, didn't know why. So they went to a dive shop. And people went out and dove, and they found an underwater forest, which sounds absolutely crazy. Yes. But there are stumps in place. There are branches everywhere. People have actually found some leaves even that are locked away. So what we were doing on this last trip we went down in December was we wanted to figure out what was living there, because – much in line with this show, the way we know evolution works is it forces animals or the animals that are able to adapt to solve these problems over evolution are the ones that survive. And so living on wood is a really tricky thing to do. And so there are all these animals that only live on wood, and they've come up with these just amazing solutions for how to do that. And a lot of that involves making chemicals that allow them to do that. So part of our team wanted to go down and see what kind of chemicals they could find with to make medicine from it.
Right.
We were really interested to see what different kinds of animals there were, whether it was different from what was in the surrounding water. And so we were diving on this 60,000-year-old underwater forest, which was just
wow.
Mind-boggling to me.
Yeah. Were there, like, roads through this forest, like paths?
Yeah, so the place that we dove was actually an ancient riverbed. And so when we went down, you could easily imagine if you've ever been in kind of like a canoe or a boat and you go along and see a forest that goes right up to the water's edge and all the roots are sticking out and the trees are right at the edge. That's a lot what it looked like, because you could see the tree roots sticking out. There was wood that was coming out that was buried in mud and kind of falling into what used to be this ancient riverbed. So we were just swimming along the edge of what used to be this river that was now 60 feet underwater.
Wow, that's really incredible. What was it like? How did you feel swimming along this river that was under the ocean?
To be honest, it was really spooky. So I've been diving for a really long time. But it was this beautiful sunny day. And so we were expecting to go down there and have everything go perfectly. We got down and it was like swimming in chocolate milk. We realized we couldn't see our hands in front of our faces. We knew that there were sharks in the area. And you know, even though they usually don't bother you, it still is in the back of your mind that you're swimming around and you can't see what's 2 feet behind you. So it was it was both exciting and a little spooky the first time we went down.
I mean, I don't even know what to say for that, right? like, how do you go down? That's like being in a completely dark room and then trying to have to move your way around, kind of like I assume you swim with your hands in front of you so you know what's coming. I mean,
yeah, it's almost like if you went into a dark room and you knew that there was a railing that you could hang on to, or you just put your hand on the wall, okay, so you have something to touch. That's kind of what we would do, is we would go along and then swim along this bank and just kind of have our hand on the wall. Now, here's the interesting thing. If you went into a room that you've never been in before and you know that there are animals walking around in there in the dark with you, and you could walk into a big stump that you don't know is there. That's kind of what it was, you know, at that point. Because we had flashlights, but they didn't work because there was just so much stuff in the water that it would just bounce back.
Did you accidentally touch any creatures when you were swimming around in the muck?
So I didn't, but one of the people I was diving with went down and put his hand on what he thought was a log, and it turns out it was a turtle. And all of a sudden it moved and he jumped back because he could jump underwater because he had put his hand on a turtle fin. I'm sure the turtle was surprised too.
Well, so I'm assuming, okay, I mean, I don't know if you know this, but animals can then see themselves. Can they see better than us in that type of medium, so to speak, where it's all, or do they just swim around and it doesn't bother them?
Do you know? There are some animals that can see in different ways than people do, but in that kind of environment, probably they were just mostly hunkering down. Or if you went a little farther up away from the bottom, you could see a little bit better. So I think they were probably just kind of hanging out in place while that was happening. Now, things like sharks do have other ways of sensing the prey than people do, so they probably were doing just fine down there. But again, you know,
maybe they were doing really well because it was a good place to eat because the fish didn't know what they were doing.
You know, it could be, yeah.
So you were down there to take a look at things.
Yeah.
So how did, you know, we were talking about this a little bit before. So how did you solve the problem since everything is dark and you can't see anything? Were you able to get any data at all or?
Yeah, we were. So what we did after that first dive, we came up to the boat and you have to kind of wait in between dives. It's called off-gassing, and it doesn't mean you're sitting up there burping. It means that you're, you're letting out all that compressed air that you breathe. And so we had a meeting and said, okay, this is a situation. What are we going to do next time? So what we tried, because part of what we wanted to do was to make a map of this place. And it reminded me a lot of, you ever heard that story about five people who are all feeling an elephant and one person's feeling the tail, one feeling the trunk, and they each come back with this different idea of what it was. One person thinks it's a snake. And that's really what we were doing down there, is we were just seeing like this little teeny tiny part of it. We wanted to know what else was down there. So we went down with this big measuring tape. We tied it off to the bottom of our buoy, and then each team swam off in a different direction. So say the first team went north and we went out for 100 feet, and then we would swing along at the end of the line and go clockwise. So it's almost like a pieces of a pie.
Oh my gosh.
Chopping off one piece of the pie. Then we would go back and come back up, and the next dive team would come down and they'd start where we left off. So using that approach, we were able to at least see what else was down there. in a way that we weren't all going to the same place and we wouldn't all get lost. Because it's like, at least you can reel yourself back in at the end and know how to get back up to the boat.
Well, and I mean, if you're both going together, you could accidentally swim into each other and not even know it, right? Because you can't see you can't see the other person swimming, so you could just,
Yeah, I when I first started diving, I used to wear really dark colored gear, probably because I thought it was cool. And now I wear like really bright colored stuff because I want people to be able to find me if I get lost.
Dr. Brian, I'm wondering, when you're swimming around in the muck and you can't see your hand in front of your face, and I'm guessing your cell phone doesn't work down there, how do you communicate with each other?
Yeah, you learn hand signals. I mean, it really helps if you know the person you're diving with. And so the person I dove with was, his name is Francis Choi, and he's worked with me for a long time in my lab. He runs my lab. And so we know each other pretty well, almost to the point where you can guess what the other person is thinking. But we use hand signals. We take down, we call them slates. It's basically a piece of plastic that a pencil can write on. And we tried that. The problem is that it was so dark down there with so much stuff in the water, you couldn't even read what we were writing on the slates. And so it was, we called it diving by Braille because we were really kind of bouncing along really clumsily, trying not to run into things. But yeah, you need to rely on somebody else and work together.
It was disorienting, I would imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, because if, you know, even when you dive, I know sometimes people can get disoriented, which is up and which is down, depending on where you are in the depth. But not being able to see, wasn't that, like, were you still able to think that I'm upright, so up must be up, you know? I mean.
Yeah, that was the nice thing about being able to touch something, because you're exactly right. So going back to what you're saying about being in a dark room. Now imagine that you're not only going backwards and forwards, you're also able to climb the walls, or you're floating up and you don't know you're floating up until you're headed to the ceiling. And so it's that importance of, I mean, this experiment, everybody, we could try. Turn off the lights in the room until it's really dark. Don't do it if there's anything you're going to really bump your head into. But it's really important just to be able to touch something, because it gives you that reference point of where you are, that you know you're in the bottom. And it's comforting. I mean, it was scary. I mean, I grew up thinking that scuba diving was all going to be, you know, being able to see for miles and miles underwater and these beautiful, pristine waters. But you know, I found out that lots of times it's like this. It's like you can't see anything, but you still have to get the job done. So you just sit down and remind yourself that, yeah, I know what I'm doing and I'm going to be careful and I've got other people with me who I trust and you get it done.
So you give yourself a pep talk when you're done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I mean, it's sometimes pretty scary down there, but, I love it.
Well, and then of course we're talking that you're diving at 60 feet, right? So you can't just go up really fast if you get nervous or whatever, right? You have to be aware of the depth.
Yeah, you can really get hurt if you do that. And so when you're breathing out of a scuba tank, all that air is squished into the tank at high pressure, and then you breathe it, and your body is under pressure too. And so if you come up too fast, it makes bubbles in your blood or in your lungs. It can really, really hurt you. And so you really have to make sure you come up slowly. You don't hold your breath. That's part of the training that you do.
I'm wondering, Dr. Brian, what was the most amazing thing you learned from this expedition?
So it was almost like stepping back in time to see something that was 60,000 years old. And one thing I should have said is when we pulled this wood out, it looked like something that you could throw in a fireplace. It was all the colors are there. The bark was still on there and it was locked away. And to know that it had been locked away in this pristine vault, I guess is what kind of want to think about it. And that we were discovering it. It was this reminder that there is so much out there that we don't know yet. I mean, this was really rare, but there are probably more places like this. I mean, it's absolutely true that we know more about the surface of the moon than we do the bottom of the ocean. And so there's all this stuff out there to discover. that we have no idea about. And this was just like looking at one little tiny piece of that. So that to me was the most amazing thing. It was just this really cool reminder of how much there is to do in the ocean.
Dr. Brian, one of our listeners, Stephanie, she has a question for you.
I was wondering if you need more people to become aquanauts.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we need a lot more aquanauts. We need a lot more people to start exploring the ocean.
Well, because you guys have only explored what? There's a percentage. What is it? 3%, 5%?
It's like less than 5% or something like that.
It's less than 5%.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something really, really small. And so there's just so much to do. And, the ocean provides so much. Every other breath we take is oxygen from the ocean, right?
Yep.
And so, we're really kind of racing to try to figure out how the ocean works.
Do you have anything that you'd like to say to kids who maybe want to become aquanauts or study marine biology?
Yeah, do it. Please do it. you really need people. And I guess the one thing is that there's no one right way to do it. There's no like set path that you have to do first this and then this. It's all figuring out what you're good at and following your passions. So I have colleagues who are really good at photography or artwork. I have others who are really good at storytelling. Some people I work with are really good engineers. And so there are all these different strengths that you can bring to the table. So I think it's figure out what you love to do and then just practice it. And it's never too early to start practicing that and learning everything you can.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. I mean, you know, when my background is I started a science club in my garage when I was 7, and here I am all these years later, you know, talking to scientists. And while I don't always get to go out in the field, I'm so excited to learn about stuff like this. It's like the little kid in me is going, oh my gosh.
Well, exactly. That's exactly what we need. I mean, that's, I think inside every scientist is a kid who gets really excited about this stuff. I mean,
it's
amazing. It's an amazing world out there.
Dr. Brian, you're right. It is an amazing world. And this has been an amazing interview. And I just love learning all about being an aquanaut. But, you know, we would like to make our show totally interactive. So right now, it's time for
The Challenge.
Brian, on Solve It, we like to have a challenge for all of our listeners. So what challenge do you have for our listeners today?
Sure. So the challenge we faced was having to dive underwater where we couldn't see anything. So what I would want everyone to do is to make their own forest. You can make it out of anything. Make it something soft so you don't bump your head, but make it out of pillows, make it out of cardboard. Make your own underwater forest someplace in your living room and do what we did. Run a string through it, run anything through it that you can follow with your hands. And then just to make it more fun, let's make your parents do it too. So why don't you hide something in there, like some pennies or some candy, and say, all right, mom and dad, here's a blindfold. I want you to be an aquanaut and find your way through the forest.